great pleasure to present you to this audience and also at this institute. So, you probably had the pleasure to listen to the best lineup you could get that could introduce you to the idea that rhythmic activity is important for brain functioning and cognition. In my talk, I'm going to look at the question to what extent this might be also relevant for brain disorders, and especially in the case for schizophrenia. I think that over the last 10 years, the research that some of the investigators here have performed during normal brain functioning has had quite an impact on the field of schizophrenia research through trying to understand what these oscillations may have to do with schizophrenia. So in my talk, I'm going to look at these three different questions. I'll first give you a brief introduction on schizophrenia and the possible importance of studying rhythmic activity. In the second part of my talk, I'll introduce you to our more recent work with MEG, both in patient populations and also looking at the effects of NMDA receptor antagonists such as ketamine in normal volunteers, and to what extent this may mimic some of the abnormalities that we can see in clinical populations. And finally, I'll talk in the final section on the developmental modifications during adolescence and what this may have to do with the pathophysiology of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia, well, most of you know what it is, so let me just summarize the main points. It's a very severe disorder, quite prevalent, with a lifetime incidence of roughly 1%. It constitutes, or is constituted by, these different domains of psychopathology. On the one hand, we have positive symptoms, so an excess of behavior as expressed in hallucinations and delusions. We have also a negative symptom domain where we have an absence or reduction of, for example, behavior, poverty of speech and affect. And thirdly, we have disorganization of thought and behavior, such as thought disorder. Now, although we have been looking at the causes of this disorder for 100 years, it's still rather unclear what the underlying biological or psychological mechanisms might be that give rise to this rather complex syndrome. Now, and this is not only of scientific interest, this has, I think, tremendous social and clinical implications, because there has been very little progress over the last 50 years in the improvement, for example, of standard pharmacological therapy. So basically that the outcome hasn't really dramatically improved for patients once they're diagnosed. So in over 70 to 80% of cases, there will be a lifelong dependence on antipsychotics. Life expectancy is reduced per average of up to 20 years compared to the normal population. This is due to the side effects, other medical complications. So this is an enormous medical problem, and I don't think this is as apparent or as obvious to society as it should be. Now, I think that over the last 10 years, there has been a reconceptualization of how to approach this important problem, and this can be captured by this idea of translational research, which we already have heard about. So basically, this means that we're trying to take the insights of cognitive neuroscience, basic neuroscience, and trying to apply this to clinical issues. And I think one of the key messages I would like to put across is that oscillations are a very, maybe even a key part for such an endeavor. As you've already heard, they can be studied at different levels of investigation. And moreover, they also emphasize neuronal dynamics, which might be crucial for understanding also not only normal brain functioning, but also brain disorders. Moreover, we have some general ideas of how these oscillations are generated. We just had an excellent presentation that gave you some insights into the underlying mechanisms that generate different frequencies. This is a schematic diagram that basically captures some of the ideas that already have been expressed by previous speakers. In particular, high-frequency oscillations in the gamma-band range are dependent upon the interplay between excitation and inhibition. So we have pathalamine interneurons that have been shown to mechanistically generate these high-frequency oscillations. And furthermore, they are also receiving excitatory input, among others, by NMDA or AMPA receptors. And together, these are the key players for understanding high-frequency oscillations in the normal cortex. And as you will see, there's evidence in schizophrenia that this excitation-inhibition balance is disturbed. Moreover, obviously, there's also the contribution of long-range cortical-cortical connections that are important for basically assuring synchronization across distant brain areas. So what is the evidence for impairments and oscillations? I'm being a bit chauvinistic in terms of the frequency range of interest, probably of decade-long conditioning in Frankfurt. But let me assure you that we're not only looking at gamma activity, but for the moment I'll focus on this particular frequency range. Is Pascal still here? I don't know. Anyhow, so what is the evidence of disturbed high-frequency activity in schizophrenia patients? The evidence so far suggests that we have reductions during different states of engagement of a cortex. For example, if we try to entrain cortical circuits at high frequency ranges with auditory steady state paradigms, we find that patients with schizophrenia are less able to entrain, for example, to 40 hertz stimulation. This is less the case at lower frequencies, so there seems to be a very basic impairment in the generation of these high-frequency oscillations. There's also evidence, for example, also by Kevin Spencer, who has carried out a lot of work in these areas of gamma-band synchronization in EEG data. And what is really important, has captured the interest of schizophrenia researchers, is that these kinds of data are consistent with important dysfunctions, for example, in GABAergic interneurons. We have reduced expressions of GAT67, in particular also a pronounced decrease in pathalamine-expressing interneurons, and also in NMDA receptor-mediated neurotransmission. And this altogether has stimulated a lot of research and debate as to how these different dysfunctions can actually be linked, and also in terms of the mechanistic functions of such deficits. In the next couple of slides, I'll show you our recent attempts to investigate these high-frequency oscillations with MEG. We have started off many years back with EEG and then moved to this technique, and my impression is that in addition for normal brain functioning, it's also a very sensitive and powerful tool to investigate abnormal rhythmic activity, and probably would make the case that it is somewhat more sensitive to high frequency activity compared to standard EEG recordings. It also has maybe a somewhat improved spatial resolution. We can carry out advanced source localization, as Marcus has already shown. And moreover, the data you obtain a very high dimensional data, and in theory, maybe even in practice, this could be ideally suited for discovering biomarkers. So this is the holy grail psychiatry, finding an index that allows you to diagnose perhaps or stratify patients into distinct categories. Let me give you some examples of how we go about this. We have been somewhat attached to these Mooney faces, which is a visual stimulus, consisting of photographs of human images where all shades of gray are removed. If you present them in an upright presentation, you're normally able to detect the outline of human face by virtue of grouping these contour elements into a coherent gestalt. If you present these faces in an inverted and slightly scrambled condition, normally no gestalt-like percept occurs. We present those stimuli for 200 milliseconds, and the subject has to indicate via a button press whether a phase is perceived or not. So it's a pretty simple task. We present different versions of these. These were actually developed by a Canadian psychologist in the 1950s to study the development of closure processes. Let's first look at the spectrum that we get during normal brain states. So this is now sensor data, time frequency, power charts in response to the phase condition. This is time analysis between 30 and 200 hertz. What you see basically following the onset of a stimulus is a increase starting from 50 milliseconds onwards, covering a broader range of frequencies and then settling in around a frequency of roughly 80 hertz following by an onset of response. What is interesting is, and this was maybe somewhat surprising to us, that we found quite a pronounced shift in frequency ranges from previous EEG data. So in MEG, you tend to pick up more of these high frequency ranges, mainly between 60 and 100 hertz. So we have more sensitivity to these higher gamma band ranges. I think it's an interesting question. What this means, is this evidence for a strict oscillatory process? But clearly, we seem to get a slightly different frequency band than, for example, with EEG. We can then compare the conditions, and we can detect a fairly transient window between 200 and 250 milliseconds where there is an upregulation here in controls in gamma band activity compared to the phases versus to the no phases. Okay. Now, I'll leave you with that and come to the data that we have from schizophrenia patients with the same paradigm. So again, this is sensor data. This is the scenario that we have in controls. And now we look at the responses in chronically medicated patients. This is a sample of roughly 20 patients during the same task. These are correctly behavioral responses. So even when patients identify correctly the Mooney phases, you see a pronounced depression of this high-frequency response, involving both the early evoked but also this induced component. Now, when we quantify this with statistical tools, so we have these 275 sensors, we still, despite the high-dimensional data, we get a very pronounced reduction, in particular in the 60 to 120 hertz frequency range over these parietal sensors, where schizophrenia patients have a marked reduced amplitude in this frequency range. And the effect size is quite substantial. It's 1.26. This is in the range of the best ERP indexes that we have in schizophrenia research. So it's a strong effect. Even when we take these large number of sensors into account, we can then also perform a beamforming. Now we localize where in the brain there is a reduction in these high-frequency oscillations. So this is a contrast for controls versus schizophrenia patients, and the red regions show you those areas where patients with schizophrenia have reduced high-frequency activity, and this is particularly pronounced in the right temporal and inferior frontal cortex and also in the fusiform face area. We can also then look at to what extent there are correlations with symptoms. So is this in any way related to the clinical state of a patient? And what we found was that a particular type of syndrome I introduced you earlier on to these three distinct types of symptom domains, we found that patients who are particularly disorganized, who have difficulty generating coherent thought, were particularly reduced in the high-frequency activity, suggesting that the more disorganized these patients were, the stronger was the reduction in this high-frequency activity at the sensor level. So this is quite a substantial correlation. Now, an important question is, to what extent are these deficits present at illness onset? So we were quite fortunate to have a sample of never-medicated first-episode patients. These days, it's quite difficult to get patients who don't take antipsychotic medications, but I think it's quite important. We've learned that antipsychotic medications can sometimes lead to gray matter loss, and it probably has also an impact on these signals that we're picking up. So this is a comparison between the chronic patients, chronically medicated, and in blue, the first episodes patients, and in black, these are the controls for the time course of 60 to 120 hertz spectral activity. What we find is that the first episodes also have an impairment, but what you can see is that this impairment isn't quite as pronounced as what we're seeing in the chronic patients. This is consistent with other data suggesting that there might be a progressive element in the cortical dysfunctions during the early stage of a disorder, as also shown by other, for example, ERP data, suggesting that the current treatments may not kind of hold the dysfunctions that might be leading to cognitive deficits, for example, in the early course of a disorder. This is the statistical analyses of these first episode patients. So these are sensor maps comparing those regions where first episodes have a dysfunction compared to controls for the early evoked and the induced window. Again, we find that the high frequency band between 60 and 120 hertz shows the largest deficit. And what we also observed was that there was a marked upregulation of beta band activity in the first episodes, which was due to the fact that the first episodes failed to downregulate this activity. So following stimulus onset, you see a marked reduction in this activity. The high gamma band goes up, and this is something that first episodes don't do as well as controlled. So there seems to be a failure to downregulate this irrelevant activity. A cross-frequency analysis also shows that this failure to downregulate is linked to this deficit in high-frequency activity. I've mentioned the issue of biomarkers. We've played around with some machine learning algorithms to see which of these different frequency bands carries the best discriminative power to classify controls versus schizophrenia patients, first episodes. And what we found was that the high frequency band between 60 and 120 hertz was most discriminative. So if we blindly classify subjects based on the signal from these posterior sensors, we have an accuracy of 90%, which is not too bad. However, it has to be said that this deficit, unfortunately, and as with lots of other things that we're measuring, it's not specific to schizophrenia. We also find that, for example, in adult autists, that this high frequency range is also impaired. So while this is quite nice, it's more important that we also find markers that are diagnostic specific. And as far as this is concerned, we're not very far yet. Coming to the issue, to what extent these dysfunctions are perhaps compatible with the NMDA receptor dysfunction. Now, why are NMDA receptor dysfunctions of interest to schizophrenia or schizophrenia researchers? Well, the reason is that we know for a long time that if you block the NMDA receptor in healthy controls, you get within a very brief period of time a psychotic state, which is remarkably similar to what you see in clinically manifested schizophrenia patients. It's the best model psychosis we have. It's better than, for example, increasing dopamine tone or anything else, suggesting that this may possibly provide an important insight into the pathophysiology of a disorder. There's also more recent evidence suggesting that risk genes that modulate the function of the NMDA receptor, for example, are targeted by copy number variations. So this is really important kind of area for us to understand. And moreover, there's very interesting and consistent data that reducing NMDA drive dysregulates neural oscillations in a very profound and major way. This is data from Didier Penaud from Strasbourg, who administered systemically ketamine in the rat neocortex. And what you see here is the spectral power between 30 and 80 hertz. And following ketamine administration, you see this wild increase in high frequency activity. And this is a very consistent feature of almost any animal model that has examined ketamine or more specifically targeting NMDA receptors, an increase of spontaneous activity following ketamine administration. The question is, do we see something similar in schizophrenia? Might there be a state where perhaps there is an upregulation of high-frequency activity? And for this to test, we also looked at the resting state, so the spontaneous activity and the MEG, and in particular in these medicated, unmedicated first episode patients. What you see here is now a contrast of the source power during the resting state between controls an unmedicated first episode patients, where the blue colors show you an increase in high frequency activity between 30 and 90 hertz in first episodes and controls. And what you see here very clearly, okay, where's Robert Knight?
Talk faster.
Right. That's my savior. Was I so bad that...
It's just getting tired.
It's been involved in too many talks. It wants to rest.
Okay.
Yeah, you're good. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. So what you see here is that during the resting state, there's an upregulation of high-frequency activity in an interesting network involving hippocampus, parahippocampal gyrus, inferior temporal cortex, middle temporal gyrus, and also cerebellum, suggesting that the resting state activity may be somewhat different from what we see during task-related activity. However, it should be important to point out that this is probably not an oscillatory process, but rather an increase in broadband activity that we seem here to be increased in the first episode sample. What is, I think, even more interesting is the fact that we don't see this in either chronically medicated patients or autistic patients. So this is maybe something of a specific marker for the acute psychotic first episode state. This also correlates to some degree with the presence of positive symptoms. We also have computed some connectivity measures between these sources, suggesting that these are also coherent between each other. This is, in a second step, also consistent with what we find in healthy controls when they receive ketamine. So we took some interested healthy volunteers and asked them to take ketamine. So they first get a bolus. Well, some actually enjoy it. No, not kidding. And they get a bolus, and then we keep them stable at a sub-anesthetic dose for roughly 1.5 hours. We record resting state activity and also a task-related pattern that I'll show later on. And what you see here now is the response to ketamine versus the placebo saline condition, again during the resting state, in the source space for the high-frequency activity between 25 and 90 hertz. The blue colors show you those regions which show again, an upregulation in response to ketamine, and what you see here is a broadband upregulation similar to what we saw in the first episodes in a network, but as I think is also consistent with animal data. We have the largest effect in the hippocampus, in the thalamus, and of course also a large number of cortical regions, but clearly showing that you can basically get a similar pattern that has been shown to be the case in animal models of schizophrenia, but also maybe in first episodes, showing that ketamine recreates these kinds of abnormalities. While there is an increase in the high-frequency part of the signal, we find that for lower frequencies, there is a decrease that covers the theta, alpha, and beta band. So basically, this is one kind of similar trend. We have, on the one hand, a decrease in this frequency following ketamine, but the upregulation of the higher frequency ranges. Obviously, this calls for a cross-frequency perspective, and this is what we're currently actively investigating. So during normal, especially resting state activity, we know that the alpha strongly modulates the broadband activity in the, for example, higher frequency ranges. And what we suggest is that perhaps in schizophrenia, this modulation, especially of alpha activity, is significantly impaired, maybe leading to a dysregulated high-frequency cortical activity that may underlie some kind of symptom expression. We can also show in the normal resting state that thalamic alpha is crucially involved in the regulation of cortical gamma. You wonder, well, how can you show this? We have some, I think, convincing MEG data to show that we can actually tap into this. And but I'm not showing this because this may be leading too far. But I think this might be an important mechanism to understand, for example, this dysregulated activity, both in first episode, but also maybe understanding this ketamine effect. As suggested earlier on, we also have looked at the effects of task-related activity in relationship to NMDA hypofunctioning, and we've used this paradigm from Pascal Fries's lab, which I think is one of the best paradigm to robustly elicit high-frequency activity. Overall, I think we still lack good paradigms for EEG or MEG research that are robust on the one hand, and second, also are cognitively meaningful. So in our search for something that robustly elicits high-frequency activity, we chose this paradigm here, which involves the presentation of a scene with grading, and at some point there is an acceleration in this grading. It reminds me a bit of the of the Jungle Book. You remember the snake Ka with the psychedelic eyes that were kind of focusing on you? It's a little like this, especially if you're taking ketamine. I think that certainly has a psychedelic quality. Anyway, this task does something very beautiful because it robustly elicits high-frequency activity, basically lasting for up to 1.5 seconds with an excellent signal-to-noise of up to 200% compared to baseline. It's absolutely robust. The peak frequency, as Pascal has shown, is highly genetically heritable, so it's a really great measure for assessing these high-frequency oscillations. Now, the question is, how does ketamine change? Well, I have to disappoint you a little because we haven't got a clear result. So these faint lines here show you the differences between the ketamine administration in red here, this is the spectral power, and in blue, this is the saline condition. However, we can actually show on single subject basis that there is a profound effect. We've measured so far 13 subjects, and in the large majority of cases, you see a strong increase following ketamine in even this task-related activity, but there are two or three subjects that show the complete opposite effect for some interesting reasons. There might be, maybe not surprisingly, inter-individual variability of maybe response to ketamine. So overall, it seems that, at least in the sensor analyses, there isn't a strong difference, but certainly there is, at the individual level, a strong response, differential response even to ketamine. This is just some schizophrenia patient data with the same paradigm, just showing you that with this you get a large reduction in this high-frequency response. So in blue, this is the amplitude here for controls, and in red, this is, again, chronic patients, and you see a marked depression of this high-frequency response during this paradigm. It's quite a large effect again. In the final part of my talk, I'd like to look at the role of developmental modifications in neural oscillations. And in particular, many years back, we became interested in the question, well, why actually does schizophrenia happen during this late time window of development, that is, during the transition from adolescence to adulthood? This has been known for a long time. Schizophrenia patients typically manifest their symptoms or the full symptoms in their early 20s. Moreover, the expression of schizophrenia or the diagnosis is normally preceded by an extended prodromal phase that can last up to 5 years, where patients already show mild psychotic symptoms, they show cognitive deficits. So that one of the really core and central issues in schizophrenia research is trying to identify those subjects who are in this developmental period who may be showing abnormal behavior that could be predictive of later transition to schizophrenia. And I think this may also require basically to examine what actually is happening here during brain maturation, and we have focused on some of the modifications in neural oscillations during normal brain development to see what actually happens during this time window. In the first study that we did a couple of years ago, we used again these Mooney faces. Now this was with EEG data, and we examined a cohort of healthy children and adolescent and adult subjects between 6 and 21 years. And this shows the differences in spectral power during different age ranges in response to these Mooney faces. In the adults, we found this strong high frequency activity here between 40 and 70 hertz. So this was between 18 and 21. And what was very surprising to us and very intriguing was that basically there was a strong increase in the occurrence of these high-frequency oscillations such that the late adolescent and early adolescent subject had a marked decreased expression of these high-frequency oscillations, suggesting that during adolescence, these high-frequency oscillations undergo major developmental modifications. We also had performed other analyses involving phase synchrony that showed some very complementary and important modifications. But I would like to quickly introduce as a second study where we looked at now the development of visual working memory and neural oscillations with MEG, with this paradigm where we present three items here. So you have to memorize the spatial positions in this array. You have a delay period, so the the encoding display is removed and you have to memorize or maintain the spatial positions, followed by the presentations of a test stimulus where you have to indicate via a button press whether this stimulus was in the original display. We have three different experimental conditions. In the second condition, we introduce these distractors, so items that have a blue color, so you have to basically blend out or inhibit the those blue stimuli. And then, importantly, we have a third load condition. In both load conditions, you have the same number of visual presented items. Yeah, you have six items. However, the interesting difference here is that they differ in the number of relevant items. So where here you have to maintain three relevant items, here you have to maintain six relevant items. So one question that interests us for a start was which frequencies actually differentiate between these two conditions, which frequency underlie the maintenance of relevant information in working memory. So we examine this with MEG. I'll show you quickly the results from the adult data. So this is spectral power at the sensor level. We'll focus only on the delay period. So this is where the encoding display is removed and you simply have to internally maintain the position of these items. And you see here the responses for 20 subjects for the different load conditions, load 3, the distractor, and the load 6. And what we observed was that only the gamma band range seemed to differentiate between the load 6 condition and the distractor condition, such that, so this is the time course here during the delay period, that the 40 to 60 hertz power was significantly upregulated to load 6 condition and compared to the distractor. So suggesting that the gamma seemed to closely reflect the number of relevant items maintained in working memory. This was not found for alpha. We could also then source localize these data, and we found two regions which were significantly modulated by these three conditions. The one was the left BA9, and the second condition was the right IPL. We could then zoom into the brain regions that showed these task effects and reconstruct the time courses in those particular voxels. This is what you see here. The spectral power for BA9 showed that, again, for the load condition 6, there was a marked increase for the 6 relevant items compared to the distractor and the load 3 conditioning, which was specific to the BA9 region because we didn't see this in the IPL. So it seemed that the left PSC was specifically involved in the maintenance of these relevant items. We could also predict from source reconstructed single trials using a decoding approach that this was predictive for the number of working memory items. This is something you can read further in the publication, but I think this shows something quite neat about working memory oscillations. But coming to the issue of how these oscillations during working memory change again during development, we investigated a subject group of 90 normal adolescents and adults between 12 to 40 years with the same paradigm. We saw during development an increase in working memory capacity. So this is 12 here and this is 24. A significant increase across development. We also found that the reaction times significantly decreased and also the response accuracy, for example, to distractor stimulus. This is something you would expect. And these are sensor analyses which examine the developmental modifications in alpha oscillations. In 12 to 14-year-olds, basically you saw a very faint alpha signal during the maintenance period. So this is normally a very prominent signal that you see in the adult cortex and which you can find here in the 21 to 24-year-olds. Here you see the developmental curve showing really a very pronounced increase in this alpha band activity during adolescence, during working memory maintenance. A similar effect we're seeing again in the gamma band. So during 12 to 14-year-olds, we saw that this gamma delay activity was fairly weak and again showed a strong modification during development. This is the time course here to the distractor condition. This is 12 to 14, and again, a strong increase until early adulthood. Probably the most impressive effect was now when we did single trial analyses comparing the responses to the distractor and to the load 6 condition. Okay, it has previously been shown that the stronger you upregulate the gamma activity or also ERP activity to the load 6 condition as opposed to the distractor, the better your working memory capacity is. Okay, so you spend less capacity or high frequency activity processing distractors, and this is now the difference on single trial levels between the load 6 and the distractor condition. And what you see is that prior to years to age 18, there is only a small difference, but following basically this period, roughly around 18 years, you see a marked increase in the way this is modulated. Okay, so it's almost a not all or none affair that following this kind of time period, there is a marked improvement in the way these high frequency oscillations are regulated during working memory and distractor processing. So this is only sensor data. We'll then investigate how this looks at the source level and how, for example, PFC maturation might be involved in this. In the final two slides, let me just show you that these data are consistent with major modifications in transmitter systems that support high-frequency activity. This is data showing the expression of NMDA receptors on fast-spiking cells during different developmental periods here in the rat PFC. During early development, wow, hello. Okay. This is a test. All right. Anyhow, so we were talking about NMDA receptors. So during early development, we find that a large percentage, up to 70% of fast-spiking cells have an NMDA component. But during development, this expression of NMDA receptors is markedly reduced, so that only up to 26% of fast-spiking cells have an NMDA receptor drive in the adult cortex. Now, this is also interesting from a perspective that only in the adult cortex you can get psychomimetic effects of ketamine, not in younger children or early adolescents. So I think this is very interesting evidence, which maybe raises the question of the relationship, perhaps, of these modifications with the psychomimetic effects of ketamine. We've heard about the importance of inhibition. This is data from David Lewis showing the changes in alpha-1 and alpha-2 subunit expressions in the DLPFC of monkeys. During development, you find that the alpha-1 unit increases in expression, so this is messenger RNA data, and the alpha-2 unit is decreased. Okay, this actually has measurable physiological consequences, because if you then look at the decay time of the inhibitory postsynaptic potential, you find that this is significantly decreased in the postpubertal or adult DLPFC compared to the kind of immature PFC, and this could be one reason why the adult cortex is able to generate higher frequency oscillations. So these are not minor things that happen during adolescence. These are important modifications, which I think are also of obvious relevance for neuronal dynamics and their modifications during development. All right, let me summarize some points that I tried to make. I hope to have shown that schizophrenia is associated with abnormal rhythmic activity, especially at higher frequency ranges. And I think this already has led to lots of efforts trying to link this with physiological mechanisms. And I think this is maybe one good way of trying to discover pathophysiological causes and perhaps, based on those approaches, scientifically based ways of modifying this either through, for example, novel pharmacological treatments or also maybe cognitive remediation. Using our MEG approach, these deficits are particularly apparent in the higher frequency ranges with MEG. These may be state-dependent and vary over the course of the illness, and it seems that they're somewhat consistent with the role of NMDA receptors. In the last part, I tried to show that There are important modifications in the occurrence of these oscillations and also in the accompanying EI balance parameters. And I think this will be important for understanding perhaps why this disorder emerges during this late stage of brain development. And also this might be important for trying to identify subjects who are at risk for the development of the disorder. I'd like to acknowledge the people who did the work. Frederick Rube did the work on working memory development, David Revolta on the ketamine data, and Tobias Navarro-Schroeder on the first episode resting state data. Thank you.
Time for questions. Yes.
Thanks, Peter. That was illuminating. There was a lot of information there. And I only digested some of it because you're the last talk in the day, so pardon my. So one of the things that really strikes me is this NMDA receptor component.
Yes.
And of course, you're going to know, you can predict that I'm going to say that it might have something to do with lower frequencies.
Yes.
It's interesting, when we haven't published these data yet, but we've given local microinfusions of NMDA receptor antagonists, non-competitive ones, and competitive blockers. And what we see is a failure of low-frequency entrainment coupled with that high gamma buzz. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you see a big elevation of gamma, just like you're showing here, but one of the things that seems to go with it is that low frequency suppression. Now, you were showing alpha suppression, but it's actually very general for lower frequencies. And that's interesting by itself because, when these circuits are operating, kind of running along, and the low frequencies are in high roar, there's a lot of coupling. So you can sort of disrupt that coupling. So I wonder if that's mechanistically. Are you thinking along those lines?
Or, yeah, I would,
one last thing. Miles just showed me yesterday in one of his models. He's got a model for delta oscillation that involves a really nice NMDA receptor component. So that all kind of fits together in a very interesting way. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're definitely thinking along those lines that you mentioned, because we're just seeing this really disbalance between high frequency activity and lower frequency ranges. So we're definitely going to look at cross frequency coupling, and I'm convinced that there will be something that I think might be explaining this kind of dysregulation. Also, for the first episodes, we really have strong evidence that during normal resting state activity, the cortical gamma is really strongly paced by especially alpha. And I could well see that this may explain some of these dysregulated high-frequency components that we're seeing both during ketamine and in the first episodes.
Thank you very much. Many people emphasize the role of prefrontal cortex in the cognitive aspects of schizophrenia. And when you were talking about ketamine, you were emphasizing changes in the hippocampus and the temporal areas. And so I wonder what you think about the role of NMDA in the frontal cortices.
So this is only resting state activity. And here we don't really see, we have some frontal regions, but they're a little lower down the line. So we have middle frontal gyrus where we have this kind of upregulation. But the main changes seem to occur in thalamus, hippocampus, and temporal cortex. So,
and do you think that's because it's resting state?
Yes, well, possibly. I mean, I think if we were to look into the role of PFC and ketamine, we would probably be looking at the We probably would have to look at this working memory task where we have a stronger frontal involvement. But I would never make the claim that schizophrenia is primarily a disorder of the PFC. Mm-hmm. I think it's really a systemic disorder. At least this would be my take on it.
May I have another question? So you were emphasizing NMDA, and once again, some of what's emphasized within the field has to do with disorders in dopamine. Hmm. And so would you comment on the relationship between the two, or how you see dopaminergic problems?
Well, it's of course an important question, which what might be primary, and I guess it's always difficult to say. I certainly know of evidence suggesting that if you reduce the NMDA receptor drive, you also just regulate dopamine activity. I think some people would say that actually dopamine abnormalities might be secondary to glutamatergic differences. I think apart from that, it still would be interesting to see, for example, in MEG data, what dopaminergic dysregulation does to oscillations. But I think I probably would tend more to emphasize NMDA dysfunctions, and this may drive some dopaminergic abnormalities.
Thank you.
Thank you. People say that schizophrenia is pretty heterogeneous, and in our genomic data, we certainly find the same thing, that there's much greater variability in gene expression. Can you comment on the variability in your schizophrenic subjects in the measures you've taken, particularly of this high gamma?
Well, so this is always a problem. Of course, it's not the case that all patients are completely distinct if you look at the distribution from normal controls. However, with the classification that we did, this seems to suggest actually that there is a fairly good separation between the schizophrenia patients and the controls. But I would completely agree that there is heterogeneity, and we would really need larger patient samples, ideally with genetic information, in order to see whether we can identify subgroups. This is something that hasn't been done, but we probably would need 60 or 70 patients in order to do this in a meaningful way. However, you also have variance and heterogeneity in the controls. This is something that is always quite interesting, if not to say annoying, that sometimes the variance is as large in controls, and that you have controls who have similar values than a completely psychotic patient. And this is something that I think is also kind of puzzling.
You list the areas like thalamus and also in the previous slide, cerebellum with high T values. Do you have any doubts?
Well, I'm speaking to an MEG expert, so I have to be careful. Well, I mean, you know this better than I do, that there are limits to what you can measure with MEG. You're probably better off in resting state activity because you have larger number of data stretches that allow you to source localize this. Now, I mentioned this thalamus story, and it's actually quite cool. So we have on the one hand, we have conducted source amplitude coupling analysis in the source space. And we find coupling between the alpha phase and the gamma broadband in resting state in the visual regions. And then we've put a virtual electrode, so a region of interest, so to speak, into the thalamus. And the phase of the thalamic alpha entrains the broadband resting state gamma in the precuneus and cingulate cortex. We can also show that if we compute conduction delays between thalamus and cortex, but those are pretty much precisely matching the available physiological data. We're in the process of revision. And we've actually done a separate analysis to confirm this. Now we've taken the precuneus as a seed region and taking the gamma there, computing again source-wide coupling, and again we find the thalamus. So it seems that you can detect also those deeper sources, and this may carry some meaningful information. But I think in resting state, you may have a better chance of detecting such networks. In task-related activity with MEG, I think this is still something that needs to be explored, but obviously it would be important if you can do that.
Could you summarize differences between what you can find in EEG and MEG in schizophrenia? Because they're a little bit different signals, right?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in general, we still need more data comparing the two methodologies. I can only tell you what we found. We started off with EEG, and we didn't find a strong impairment in this, just in the spectral power in the gamma band. Okay, when we went to MEG, we had a much, much bigger effect. And there's recent data from Chris Singh's lab, MEG group in Cardiff, that compared EEG measured gamma with MEG measured gamma, and the sensitivity of the MEG measured gamma was 3 or 4 times larger than what you were seeing with EEG. So the signal to noise seems to be especially for the higher frequency, significantly improved. So this is also something that I would basically agree on, that MEG is more sensitive. I mean, you have still similar issues with artifacts, but I think you can address these a little bit better in MEG.
How can you interpret this from a physiological point of view?
You mean mechanism? What the signal means, or?
Mm-hmm. Because perpendicular somehow signal.
Well, you have somewhat different sources in their orientation, so you have differences that are differentially picked up by EEG and MEG.
Exactly. So what does that mean for schizophrenia?
Well, I mean, there haven't really been that many studies comparing directly EEG and MEG, so this is still something that we need to see. I mean, what kind of different insights you may gain. A lot of the EEG research in schizophrenia has been focused on a somewhat narrow gamma frequency range, so we haven't really looked at any higher between above 50 hertz. So this is still something that we need to look at a bit more in detail.
What would be your hypothesis?
Well, I don't yet have an hypothesis as regards to the precise differences between EEG and MEG, I have to say.
Was this sensitivity like a deviation from baseline? This is usually plotted in between MEG and EEG. Was the signal noise ratio kind of thing?
Yeah, so this is what they showed, that during simple visual stimulation, the signal to noise was 3 or 4 times increased in MEG relative to EEG. Just looking at simple visual stimulation. This is a neuroimage paper just published a couple of months ago.
But then it might be, the reason might be that EEG is something that is not modulating in addition to the modulated thing, and therefore there's something in the baseline of the EEG which is not in MEG.
Well, they suggested that it may have to do with muscle artifacts that are more prominent in the EEG and that may just suppress the kind of relevant high frequency part, and which may reduce signal to noise. This was their explanation, but this is still something that needs to be, I think, looked at further.